Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I mean, if the first weekend of The Last Dance was about Jerry Krause getting roasted, the second weekend then was about the Detroit Pistons getting hammered for their decision to walk off the floor with 7.9 seconds left in Game 4 as they were being swept by the Bulls in the 91 Eastern Conference Finals. And most of the Bulls clearly have not forgiven nor forgotten that slight, that disrespect. Starting with Horace Grant, who went here with it.
Straight up bitches.
Straight up bitches.
Straight up bitches.
Then there was Michael Jordan himself, who was told by a producer that that producer had a video explanation from Isaiah Thomas as to why they did what they did. But Mike clearly had no need for Isaiah then and has even less for him right now, and he was not having any of it.
Well, I know it's all bullshit. Whatever he says now, you know it wasn't his true actions then. You know, it's time enough to think about it. Or the reaction of the public that's kind of changed his perspective of it. Yeah, you can show me anything you want. There's no way you can convince me he wasn't that.
I mean, he said all that before even looking at the video. You can show me anything you want, but there's no way you can convince me that he's not an a-hole. So that was Horace and that was Michael. Then you had the additional beatdown that the Pistons took on Twitter 30 years after the fact, after everybody was reminded of how bush they really were. And the fact is, it was all justified. That was classless as hell. I don't care that the Celtics did or didn't do it to them a few years earlier. I don't care what the Bulls said about the Pistons in the lead-up to Game 4 of that series or in previous years. When you play the way the Pistons played, and when you live that bad boy life, and you're constantly telling the league that you're the toughest badasses ever, you need to stand there and own it when somebody else caves your face in finally. That's what actual tough guys do. You can't be a badass only when you win, but cowards when you lose. And that's exactly what leaving before the game was over said. It was a classless, cowardly move. This is why Horace Grant called the Pistons bitches.
Straight up bitches.
Correction. Straight up bitches.
Straight up bitches.
It was lame then. It's lame now. And frankly, I mean, honestly, it's too bad. And the reason it's too bad is because these Piston teams deserve a whole lot more credit than they actually get. They deserve more credit than they actually get. They ended the Boston Celtics. They beat Jordan and the Bulls 3 straight years. They won back-to-back world championships. And they damn near made it 3 straight because they were up 3-2 on the Lakers in 88. And for all the focus on their legendary physicality, it's not like they were a bunch of hacks who showed up every single night and had to beat the crap out of teams, and that was their only way to win. They had straight ballers. Even if Horace said they were straight bitches, they had straight ballers. Isaiah, Joe Dumars, Dennis Rodman, Chuck Daly, all in the Hall of Fame. And it wasn't just them. Mark Aguirre, Vinnie Johnson, Bill Laimbeer. I mean, Laimbeer, he'd drop an elbow on you, but he'd also hit you with a double-double. I mean, I can go on. The point is, that was a damn good team. Unfortunately, the walk-off was a damn classless moment. And then yesterday, you had Isaiah Thomas asked about it. And Isaiah went Isaiah and started to spin and said a bunch of things that made no sense whatsoever.
I paid a heavy price for that decision. And in paying that price, you know, I understand that this is the sports world and everything else. But at the same time, looking back over it in terms of how we felt at that particular time, our emotional state and how we exited the floor, we actually gave the world the opportunity to look at us in a way that we never really tried to position ourselves in or project ourselves in that way. So it's unfortunate that it happened.
Credit ESPN. Yeah, I guess, Zeke. I guess what he's referring to when he says he paid a heavy price is the fact that he got left off the Dream Team. But I'm not so sure that's entirely because of the walk-off. Seems to me that if in fact Mike kept him off that team, Mike's hatred of Isaiah goes back a lot further than the time that they walked off. It may have something to do with the fact that Isaiah allegedly froze Mike out of the All-Star game. You know, in terms of the problems the two of them have, it also has to piss off Isaiah, a Chicago legend back in the day, and a proud, proud dude at that, that Jordan came to town, absolutely took over, and then nobody there ever gave a damn about Isaiah ever again. Even worse, they all hated him. It's also worth noting that over the years, Isaiah's explanation as to why the team has changed. In the documentary, he says it's what the Celtics did to them. Oh, why didn't you say so? In that case, all is forgiven. Oh, the Celtics did it to you first. Why didn't you say so? All is forgiven. No, it's not. Even better is the excuse or explanation that the Bulls said mean things to them. Never mind that the Pistons physically beat the living crap out of the Bulls. The Bulls said mean things about the Pistons. They were meanies. Credit Marvin Freeman, wherever he is. The Bulls said mean things about us, so we're not going to shake their hands. The Bulls said we're bad for basketball. They said we're bad for basketball, so we're just going to be bad for basketball and walk right off the court. Yeah, but I'll give Isaiah this. At least he did apologize. Well, I think he apologized. I think he apologized for walking off the floor, but as with many things with Isaiah, I'm not really sure what he's apologizing for.
The fact that I have to sit here today and Jalen, Chris Webber, Steve Smith, who I work with, the hurt that those guys feel for me having to be in this moment, I apologize to them in Detroit for all of us in this moment. Because as a leader of the team and as a leader of that community.
What? Okay, so no apology to Mike or Scott or Phil. No apology to Chicago. But he will apologize to Jalen Rose and Chris Webber and Steve Smith and the city of Detroit for walking off. What, Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, Barry Sanders got left out? You've got nothing for Henrik Zetterberg, Nick Lidstrom, Steve Yzerman. What the hell on earth do Jalen Rose, Chris Webber, and Steve Smith have to do with Isaiah walking off on Mike, Scott, and Phil? Yeah, like, I get it. Like how long has Steve Smith been waiting on an apology because Isaiah walked off the court when Smith himself had nothing to do with that game or that series? Man, I'm so glad that Isaiah and Steve Smith could finally bury the hatchet for Isaiah walking off the floor without shaking Mike's hands. The question now is, how long before Isaiah makes it right with Calvin Johnson? You ask me? The sport's ultimate black eye. The Pistons walking off the floor on the Bulls will never begin to heal until Isaiah formally apologizes to former Lions great Calvin Johnson. And let me ask you this. I sure hope he was able to get to all-time Tigers great Al Kaline before he passed on. Because if anybody deserved an apology for the Pistons' all-time classless move, it's the great Al Kaline. I mean, Isaiah's done and said some really weird stuff over the years, but that would-be apology to everybody except for the dudes that he did it to is right near the top. I mean, my man really is confused. I'll tell you who's not confused about this, though, is my other guy, Bill Laimbeer, which I gotta respect. 30 years later, he's not coming off that. He's not apologizing to anybody for anything. Conor McGregor would be proud of Bill Laimbeer for the way he handled this. Bill Laimbeer is like, I apologize to absolutely nobody for anything. Bill Laimbeer was the original double champ who does what the bleep he wants. Lane Beer was that guy before Conor McGregor even thought about it. Now more than ever, we know that businesses are grappling with incredibly challenging times. A lot of things in life and business are changing right now, and we are all adapting to our new priorities. While it does take time to adjust, LinkedIn believes that we can create opportunity when our community comes together. Whether you're looking to hire now for a critical role or thinking about needs that you may have in the future, LinkedIn Jobs is here to help. LinkedIn is an active community with over 675 million members worldwide. LinkedIn screens candidates for the hard and soft skills that you are looking for and puts your job in front of candidates looking for job opportunities like yours. And with LinkedIn, you can hire the right person quickly when you need to. So when it's time to hire and find that right person, LinkedIn is here to help. If you need to hire for healthcare or essential services, you can also post your jobs for free. Just visit linkedin.com/Rome. Again, linkedin.com/ROME and post a job right now. Terms and conditions do apply. Pete Prisco. Pete, before we get into the draft and the NFL news, today is your 20th wedding anniversary. Happy anniversary. What kind of plans do you have for today, Pete?
Well, probably sit in here and look at the four walls and figure out what we're going to do when we actually get to get outside. You know what I mean? You know
how that sounds. That goes, awesome. Yeah. That sounds great. That,
hey,
that's
by the way,
do.
If anybody is thinking they're cashing those over-under tickets, you lost. So I got that going for me.
Nice. Good day. Have fun with it. All right. So let me start here. What did you make of the virtual draft experience overall? How'd that go for you?
You know, I thought it was outstanding, to be honest with you. I think, you know, a lot of times, all this stuff that they complain about leading into it, we hear, oh, it's going to be a disaster. And all the guys I talked to said it was as smooth as it's ever been. They had no problems whatsoever. And I think it humanized it a little bit. You got to see guys at home. And I think now, Jim, a lot of these general managers and personnel guys are going back and reevaluating, do they really need to be in the office as much as they have been over in recent years? And the answer to that question for most of them is no. And they're going to reevaluate it. And some guys say they might try and work at home for a day or two during this time of the year. And I think, you know, paralysis by analysis. And I think that's why this will actually end up being a really good draft.
Pete Prisco is joining us. Now, Pete, there is a quote circulating out there, and it's being attributed to you. I want to make sure this is real. The quote is, quote, "The Bengals will win a Super Bowl with Joe Burrow at quarterback in the next decade," end quote. Pete, did you say that or is somebody pranking you?
No, I said that, and I believe it. I love the kid as a quarterback. But more than that, it's not just him. I think that team with that roster is heading in the right direction. And Duke Tobin is a good football guy. And for all the people that criticize the Bengals, go back and look at their recent drafts. They've done a really good job. This year, it's like getting an extra number one pick when you get Jonah Williams back. I think Joe Mixon's on the cusp of being one of the special running backs in this league, and he was really good at the end of last season. You look at that defense. You get DJ Reader to put next to Geno Atkins, that front four with Hubbard and Dunlop on the edge are going to be very good. They drafted two good linebackers. I really like the Logan Wilson kid from Wyoming. And so I think they're moving in the right direction. And in the next decade, they will win a Super Bowl with Joe Burrow.
Pete Prisco is joining us. All right, Pete, each year you hand out draft grades. And as you always say, it's not an exact science by any stretch because it is so early. But your editors do love it. The fans love it. So let's talk about that for a minute. You gave an A to the Baltimore Ravens. It seems like they're consistently good in their drafting. How do you explain that?
Well, Ozzie Newsome was always outstanding, and they drafted with an eye on replacing, and a lot of teams don't do that. And by that, I mean, we've seen how many linebackers have we seen go out the door in Baltimore over the years, and they always have somebody there ready to replace them. Then they allow that guy to go out the door, and they replace them. Well, they did that again. I think getting Patrick Queen was an outstanding pick for him, but up and down the draft board, Eric DaCosta, who learned at the foot of Ozzie Newsome, has picked it right back up where Ozzie was, and they know how to maneuver a draft board and get good players. They had six picks in the first three rounds, and I loved all of them with the one exception being J.K. Dobbins. It's not that he's not a good player. I understand the thinking. In 2021, he will be their back. I probably would have waited to get a running back, but I love what they did.
We are talking to Pete Prisco. Another team that you loved and the work they did was the Panthers. You gave them an A. They drafted, or they used all their picks, Pete, on defense. Overall, what do you like about that draft?
Well, I think when you look at it, it starts with Derrick Brown. I'm on record as saying I think he might end up being the best defensive player in this draft, including Chase Young. And I love Chase Young. But Derrick Brown is a power player who just has to learn how to use his hands to become a little bit better pass rusher. I think he's going to be a force on the interior. They thought about trading up in the first round, back into the first round to get Gross Matos, the defensive end from Penn State, and they waited there, and he came to him. And Jeremy Chinn is a real playmaking safety who can, you know, be used as like a dime linebacker in certain situations as well. The defense was terrible last year. They got run on all year long. I think getting those three guys will really help change that.
I'm picking Pete Prisco's brain about the NFL draft. He's joining us. He's breaking it all down. Pete, what do you make of what the Patriots did as an example? Do you think they're retooling on the fly, or does that feel like a full-blown rebuild to you?
Oh, they're tanking for Trevor. I mean, that's what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Somebody offered that theory to me in the league. They said, watch what the Patriots do. They look like they're tanking for Trevor. They'll get Trevor Lawrence. Belichick will win another Super Bowl, and then he'll turn it over to his son, Steve Belichick, so he can win some with a great quarterback. And I thought about it, and I go, no, that's not the Belichick way. But maybe he's smarter than all of us, and maybe he realizes that without that quarterback, he's got to retool the whole thing. I didn't love their draft, to be honest with you, Jim. They did have a lot of picks. And quite frankly, his drafts haven't been as good as his reputation over the years. But they did maneuver the board up and down. They had a lot of players, and you need a lot of players if you're rebuilding.
Now, Pete, I mentioned off the very top, you are an Arizona State legend. So what did you make of San Francisco selecting Brandon Ayuk? And how do you like how do you think he'll fit in that Kyle Shanahan offense?
Oh, I love him. I think he's only scratching the surface of himself as a receiver. He only played the one year at ASU, and when he gets the ball in his hands, he's explosive, and Kyle Shanahan's a great play caller. I think Kyle Shanahan might be one of the best play callers in this league, and he will get him involved in the offense off of that run game, and he's going to be a big play threat. Love that pick. The 49ers and John Lynch get it, and I'll be honest with you. When John Lynch got the job, I thought, okay, it's just football. He'll be okay. He's 10 times better than I thought he would be.
He's unbelievable. I mean, I'm awed by what they're doing there. When you look at what they did over the last few days alone, they draft Ayuk and Javon Kinlaw. They trade for Trent Williams to replace the retiring Joe Staley. I mean, Pete, you know how this goes. Historically, teams that lose in the Super Bowl do not generally get back. And if they do, they don't win. How do you like the looks of their team going into next season overall?
Oh, I think they're a definite contender. And if Jimmy Garoppolo improves, and let's not forget, that really was, really his first year as a full-time starter. If he improves, which I think he can, they're going to be right smack dab in the mix again. The one concern I have is they didn't take a corner, which is concerning to me because the one corner opposite Sherman isn't great, and Sherman's not a kid anymore. But that team is loaded again. They'll be right in the mix.
That's fair. Pete Prisco joining us for a few more moments. So, Pete, where does Tampa Bay fit into all of this? Obviously, they get Brady, they get Gronk, they get some help on the offensive line. Where does that leave them?
I think offensively they're going to be very good. I think getting Tristan Wirfs to play right tackle, that was the one major hole they had on the offense. The line is going to be good from tackle to tackle. I mean, the interior of the line with Jensen and Marpet and Kappa was really good last year. And now you add a big physical tackle. That'll improve them. Getting Gronk in the mix will help, obviously, another weapon. But I think their season is going to be decided by what happens in the secondary. I think the front will be good. I think the linebackers can fly to the football. And we saw growth by the secondary last year. Young players at the end of last year started playing better. Guys like Jamal Dean and Bunting, they got to continue to grow, and they added Antoine Winfield to it. So for all the talk about the offense, I think the success of their season will come down to that secondary.
I love Antoine Winfield. Let me ask you this really quickly. What about Jacksonville? I'm curious to get your thoughts. In the lead-up to the draft, you had a mock draft with Jacksonville trading up to number 4 to get Justin Herbert. Obviously, that did not happen. You're not a huge believer in Gardner Minshew. Did they then make a mistake by not getting any lead quarterback?
Well, they did draft a quarterback late in Jake Luton, the guy from Oregon State, who I really like, by the way. I think he's got the big arm. I'm not saying he's going to be a starter down the road, but I do like him. I think there's still a possibility of a veteran quarterback being added to the mix. Maybe if Andy Dalton's released, they might take a look with Jake Gruden there. But it's too hard for me to say Gardner Minshew is or isn't, which is why it's a little bit of a risk. I did like their draft. I think when you look at their defensive front now, because it doesn't look like Ngakoue is getting traded, despite the fact that he wants to be. There weren't a lot of offers for him. People are concerned that he's asking for too much money. So if he's there, he's not going to sit out. They'll have three big-time pass rushers in Chaisson, who they drafted from LSU, to go with Josh Allen and Ngakoue. So I think the defense is moving in the right direction, but their whole season will be about Minshew. If he's good, they'll be decent. If he's not, they're going to have a long season, be drafted early next year.
Pete, finally, if you had to bet, where do you think Cam Newton is going to end up?
You know, that's a great question, Jim. In fact, it's a great question that I've asked a lot of guys and haven't really got an answer back on it. I figured Jacksonville would make some sense. I don't think that's going to happen. I figured the Chargers would make some sense, but now they got Herbert and they'd like Tyrod Taylor. That's a good, great question, and I really do not have a good answer. I thought maybe Green Bay is a backup, but now that they drafted Jordan Love, I don't think that's going to happen. Philly, now they drafted Jalen Hurts. I don't think that's going to happen. It's hard to find a place for Cam Newton. It's hard to believe we're saying that.
Alvin, in fact, if we're going to address this issue for the first time ever, I think I need a bed underneath me. I think I need a bed underneath this take. I think something like, I don't know, maybe something with a little pop punk feel. That's what I need. Because yesterday was a huge day for my guy, Tom DeLonge. Formerly of Blink 182, and now of Angels and Airwaves. A little background for you, a little history. This is a band that I go way back with. A group that the show goes way back with. And it started with Brian Albers. If you know this show and you go far enough back, you know Brian Albers. Brian Albers brilliantly engineered this show back in the day and trained Alvin to be the legend that he is today. In fact, Alvin, I'm thinking about putting you on mic. I know I didn't warn you of this, but I kind of want you, if possible, Alvin, to describe Brian Albers and what he's meant to you in the creative process. Is there any way you're up for that? Dude, maybe later. How about maybe never, Alvin? Anyway, Whitey trained Alvin. But back in the day, Whitey did a lot of things as it related to the show, but he bumped Blink's music on this program long before they blew up. Like Alvin, or I should say Whitey heard the band, Whitey knew their music, and Whitey started to drop them into the program, and the band appreciated that. They always appreciated that, and they appreciated the show, and they appreciated me. So we had a relationship. In fact, they appreciated me so much, they put me in one of their videos. You remember it. The one where they run through my TV studio with their dongs hanging out. Well, you didn't see it since it was blurred out in the video, but I did. And so did everybody on the set that day. The way it was positioned to me before they rolled it was they were going to roll through a number of TV shows, you know, just run right through the stage in like a skin costume. Or a skin suit. That's what I was told. And then I'm there one day and all of a sudden I see nothing but dong. Anyway, a bunch of you would mock and clown Tom when he would talk about his passion for UFOs. And then you laughed even harder when he started putting his money and time and life into searching for UFOs. And you kept on laughing when he formed to the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences. And you were going on and on about how, like, this dude bounced from one of the biggest bands of the era to chase UFOs. What a freaking loser. That's what you all thought. And now all I've got to say to all of you who are mocking him and clowning him is this. Scoreboard, look up at it. No, better yet, the sky. Look up at that, because right now the scoreboard says Tom DeLonge 3, the rest of you 0. That's right. Yesterday, the Pentagon officially released 3 short videos that show unidentified aerial phenomena. Now, this is not some X-Files conspiracy theory bullcrap or something you've read about in the checkout line at the grocery store. We're not talking about the smoking man in this one. We're talking about the bleeping Pentagon and the bleeping Navy. Let me read this opening paragraph from an article on Vice.com. Quote, the U.S. Navy has officially published 3 UFO videos that were previously published by the New York Times and former Blink 182 singer Tom DeLonge's UFO research group to the Stars Academy. Together, they are 3 of the most famous UFO videos of all time and have spurred a renaissance in UFOlogy. End of quote. Hell yes. Hell yes, they did officially publish those three UFO videos. And hell yes, they were from Tom DeLonge's research group. And if you haven't seen or heard the videos, here's some background on them, because it is pretty fascinating and a little freaky. One of the videos is from 2004. The New York Times reported the incident took place 100 miles out in the Pacific. Two fighter pilots on a training mission were sent to investigate an unidentified aircraft a Navy vessel had been tracking for weeks. So the pilots find an object roughly 40 feet long, hovering roughly 50 feet above the ocean, and it began a rapid ascent as the pilots approached. Then there's one of the 2015 videos that features an object which is rotating weirdly in midair. Here's a quick taste of the audio from that.
Dude, this is going on, bro. There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. The whole thing, dude. That's not our LNS, though, is it?
It's not. That is the LNS, dude.
Well, if there's like
look at that thing.
It's rotating.
Can you box moving target?
No, I took an auto track.
Oh, okay.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Wow.
Easy, Mav. Just kidding. Now, one pilot says, quote, dude, this is a bleeping drone, bro, end quote. Man, that's exactly the reaction you should have when you see a UFO. Dude, F-bomb, and bro. Like, dude, is that a UFO, bro? In another video, a pilot says simply, what the F is that? What the bleep is that? Which is something else you should say if you see a UFO. What the bleep is that? But I'm here to tell you exactly what the bleep that is. That's Tom DeLonge being bleeping right. That's what the bleep that is. One of the pilots who saw the unidentified object in 2004 told CNN this 3 years ago.
And as I got close to it, probably within a mile to a half mile, it rapidly accelerated to the south and disappeared in less than 2 seconds. This was extremely abrupt, like a ping pong ball bouncing off a wall. It would hit and go the other way and change directions at will.
Hey, dude, like goosebumps. But at the same time, until the videos were actually confirmed and actually declassified, it would have been crazy to get too worked up about them. This is why I never got too caught up in any of this. But now that's changed. The Navy had previously confirmed the accuracy of the videos. And according to a spokesperson, they're releasing them now, quote, in order to clear up any misconceptions by the public on whether or not the footage that has been circulating was real or whether or not there is more to the videos, end quote. In other words, they're real. And they want you to know that they're real. They're real. The Navy statement continued, quote, after a thorough review, the department has determined that the authorized release of these unclassified videos does not reveal any sensitive capabilities or systems and does not impinge on any subsequent investigations of military airspace incursions by unidentified aerial phenomena, end quote. And back to Tom, as he tweeted, quote, with today's events and articles on my and To the Star Academy's efforts to get the U.S. government to start the grand conversation, I want to thank every shareholder at To the Stars for believing in us. Next, we plan on pursuing the technology, finding more answers, and telling the stories, end quote. Now we're getting somewhere. There's phase one. Phase one is complete. Now we're getting together the technology to find more answers. So who the hell is laughing now? Not DeLonge. And just as importantly, not former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He tweeted, quote, "I'm glad the Pentagon is finally releasing this footage, but it only scratches the surface of research and materials available. The U.S. needs to take a serious scientific look at this and any potential national security implications. The American people deserve to be informed," end quote. Hell yes, we do. It's not just a couple of random pilots who claim to have seen something. And it's not just a musician with a passion for it. It is the former Senate Majority Leader putting his name and his rep on it as well. It's the Pentagon saying that the videos are in fact real. So the truth is out there, and the former Senate Majority Leader and the former Blink 182 man will find it. Damn, April 27th, 2020, the day the U.S. government confirmed Tom DeLonge's UFO videos as real and legitimate. What a day. What a year. Not even a year. What a 5 months. We're not even 5 months into the crazy year yet. What's next, 2020? You crazy, drunk bastard of a year. Let's go to the phones. We go to Hayward. Todd in Hayward. Good to have you, Todd. What's up?
Dude, I can't even believe that I'm talking to you, bro. I really can't, because I've been listening to you since before Everett came over the table. And then I hated you, dude, because I'm a Rams fan, after that happened. But I kept listening because you're the man. You're the voice of reason. And there's just, like, no freaking way right now that people are correlating the fact that you've got unidentified flying objects out there, and that somehow equals extraterrestrial or aliens. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. After all this time, I've never contacted the show, bro. Right? I never sent a fax to Script Foo. I never emailed the show. And you are not right now just saying, oh, we've got some unidentified flying objects, therefore there are terrestrials and aliens, right? Just think about, just right now, think about the drones that are out there right now, little stupid little hobby drones that have four propellers, six propellers, eight propellers. They've got little tiny little microchips that can control these things. And you're telling me that 20, 30 years ago, they didn't.
Hey, Todd, you know what I'm saying to you, Todd? I'm saying that I'm playing you off to aliens exist right now. That's what I'm saying, Todd. Thanks, Alvin. Hey, listen, I didn't say that. I didn't say that aliens exist. I did not say that, man. Stop putting words in my mouth. I did not say aliens exist. My man Dan in Michigan. What's going on, Dan? How are you?
Jerome, the blood is boiling, but man, you got the voice of an angel. Let us to the big screen. What was Todd doing on here and spitting that venom, bro? This is your show. He brings up Everett. I mean, what is he thinking, number one? Number two, you never said there were aliens. He's just saying there's stuff out there. I mean, he was out of line, and I had to listen to that. I'm happy you ran him, bro. He's talking about, I never called the show. I never did this. Well, you called the show now, and your take was terrible. So get off, get stepping. Hope your family's doing well, Romy. Peace.
You too. Be safe, Dan. Be safe. Dan just makes the show better. Jason Ayer is my guest. Jason, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Really good to have you. So I know you've been continuing to work on the series while it's been airing, which in and of itself is really curious. Where are you in the process right now, and what's a normal day like for you at the moment?
Well, we just finished our final edit of episode 10 on Friday night around midnight. So the picture is locked on the final episode, which is a major milestone. We're basically just kind of kicking the extra point at this point, before the extra point got moved back. So it's we're kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. We have to do sound design and audio mixing and color correction, but my day this week is a lot different than it's been in prior weeks, because that was just wake up, walk a few feet to my desk, and continue to collaborate with my editors and put these shows together. But the hard work, I'm happy to say, is done.
Yeah, I bet that felt great to finish that thing up. So, like, initially, what was the thought when ESPN said, you know what, we're going to move this thing up, we need to speed this process up, now would be a great time? Did you feel pressure to get that thing done? Did it mess with your creative flow and process at all?
it definitely messed with the creative flow, because so much of that creative flow occurs when you're in a room with other people. You know, this team has become a family in the last 2.5 years. So to show up at work and you know, grab a football and play catch in the hallway and talk about some ideas and go into someone's edit room and try one song here and try it again there and try a different image over this or use that picture or that picture. Those are all parts of the collaborative process that are the joy of putting something like this together. So when we're quarantined and everyone's sitting in their own apartment, we can only replicate that via Zoom and text and email, which is it's just a tedious process. And then just to see something from their computer, they have to download it and export it, and I have to import it and upload it to my Vimeo page or something like that. It's a much longer time. But I am proud to say, I think the whole team would be proud to say, that we haven't lost an ounce of quality in these final couple of episodes that we've cut at home in the last month or so.
Jason Ayer joining us. So what's it been like for you and the team to release that project into the world and then to see how it's been received?
It's been really gratifying and fulfilling. I think that we all looked at each other right at the outset of this thing. We didn't even have a chance to really say goodbye. It was just, we'll come in tomorrow, and then all of a sudden the city was shut down. But we had immediate conversations with ESPN and Netflix and the NBA, and Michael's team, and all of us were unanimous in wanting to get this out as quickly as possible to give some people just a moment of escape that they could look forward to every week, because we're living in some pretty scary, bleak times. So we felt a responsibility just to entertain people with a story here that's not too heavy, that is heavy on nostalgia. And I believe that nostalgia and sports are connectors for us all. So this, you know, it's a privilege and an honor for us to just provide something like that to people that they can discuss as a group of sports fans on Monday mornings lacking live sports.
Or even Tuesday or Wednesday, director Jason Ayer is joining us. You know, Jason, I've said since the first episode, it was kind of astounding to me that Michael even greenlit this thing, because he did have a veto over the project. But even more impressive to me is the way he has shown up. I mean, I am stunned by the way he has sat down and the way he's handled this and what he has said and the way he's answered questions. I mean, I am shocked by his candor. Were you at all surprised by that?
No one is more pleasantly surprised than I am, because, you know, there's no way I would have said no to this project, no matter what the parameters were. When you get an opportunity to tell a story like that, you just do your best with it. And if your hands are tied behind your back, then you do the best job you can. But it was quite the opposite. You know, I've been in this business for over 20 years, and I've seen how a lot of high-profile athletes are handled and protected and insulated, and there's no one more high-profile than Michael. But there was never once anything off the table for me to ask in an interview, and there was never once any sort of veto power exercised. And Michael was watching Rough Cuts just like every other executive, and there's some stuff in here as the series goes on that's not flattering. And he was eager to give context to that, because I think he wants to show what it took to be as consistently great as those Bulls teams were. So I assured him early on in the process that he would have ample opportunity to give that context, and that we'd interview teammates and opponents and coaches, and would give a comprehensive, full, honest look at exactly what went on behind closed doors. But I was watching episode 7 the other night to give it the final sign-off, and I'm still kind of blown away that he allowed some of these clips to be in there. So I'm eager for people to see it, and I'm proud that we got it on the air.
So Jason, why now? Why was he so open to doing this right now, and why is he so open to answering questions the way he is? Like, what's his agenda?
I don't know that he has one. You know, the conspiracy theory I've seen thrown out there is that LeBron was winning and you know, that the Warriors won 73 games around the time that he greenlit this. I think that if you believe anything like that, that's a reason that he would greenlight this at that time, then you believe that comes from a place of insecurity. And Michael might be the least insecure person I've ever known. The simple answer is that he really just does things when they feel right. And trust me, as someone who's tried to book interviews with him for the last 2 years, it can be a frustrating process, because sometimes it feels right and sometimes it doesn't feel right. He's not elusive. He's not evasive. He just values his own time, because he's been on other people's time for decades. And now he's finally at a place in his life where he can do whatever he wants. I truly feel like the time was right. There's been enough time between when they won those titles and now. I think he does want, not specifically young people throughout the world, but his own kids. He's got twin 6-year-old daughters who know him as nothing but daddy. They have no idea what made him great back then. And I think that he, you know, this is conjecture on my part, but just the way that he lights up when he talks about family and when he talks about what he's proud of, I think that that was a factor in his wanting to do this, is to be able to tell his story and leave that for his kids and his grandkids. So it all, like I said, it comes down to timing with him. He's very much a creature of the moment, and he might be the most present, mindful person I've ever met, and that's just in his DNA.
Interesting. Director Jason Ehrer joining us. You mentioned episode 7. In episode 7 and 8, you get into Jordan leaving to play baseball and the rumors that surrounded that. What kind of thoughts does Jordan have when he looks back on that time?
Honest ones. That's one of the aspects of this that I assumed would be off the table, was discussing his baseball career, and then even bringing up the notion of the conspiracy theories that surrounded it, that there was this secret suspension from David Stern because of his gambling habits, or that he was somehow responsible for the tragic murder of his father. Those are things that I didn't think I'd ever be able to go there with him. And within the first conversation I had with him, he was bringing those up. And this was far from cameras. This was just us talking. So I think he might not be eager to talk about these things, but he's more than willing. So in a documentary that I thought would have to just gloss over things like that, we could spend 10, 15, sometimes 20 minutes examining this. You know, the famous Baggett Michael cover on SI, he hasn't talked to Sports Illustrated since then. To this day, he holds that grudge. And in talking to him, it's kind of like the supermodel who never gets asked out because everyone's so afraid to ask her out. Well, Michael wasn't spoken to for that article. And he said, they never asked me about it. Come to me. Ask me the questions about why I'm doing this. Ask me if I think I'm embarrassing baseball. So that's where he held a grudge. It wasn't because he was embarrassed. It was because they didn't get his side of the story. So it was enlightening to me, and I hope that it's enlightening to a lot of other people too. You know, I'm from Boston, and Terry Francona is a folk hero in Boston for bringing us our first title in a million years. And Terry was Michael's manager. So we spoke to Terry. We talked to Mike Barnett, who is Michael's hitting coach, who still is Terry's hitting coach with the Indians. And we did our best to get every single side of the story that we could.
Jason Ehrer joining me for a few more moments. He is the director. So this past Sunday night, we had the story of Jordan going into the apartment and dragging Dennis Rodman out of bed after he got back from Vegas. Is it true that Jordan said he grabbed Rodman by the nose ring? And then overall, Jason, what do you make of the Jordan-Rodman relationship?
Chip Schaefer, who is the trainer, or Michael told me that, and this was, I don't believe it was on camera. I think it was just anecdotally when we were just discussing this, you know, over a beer or something before we actually had a camera crew in there. But I do remember one of them saying, you know, I doubt that he ripped Dennis's nose ring out of his nostrils, but I'm sure that Dennis probably had a nose ring in, and I bet that if he got him back to the Berto Center for practice, it probably involved yanking one of the many things that were dangling from Dennis at the moment. As far as the relationship that Michael and Dennis had, it was strictly professional. They were not golfing buddies by any stretch. There's a scene later on in the doc where they arrive at a hotel in Orlando, and the team gets off the bus, and Michael gets immediately on a golf cart to go tee off with Ron Harper because he has a tee time. They just arrive there, and they have a game later on that night. And Dennis Rodman, I don't know how colorful my language can be here, but he says he's going to Hooters to play a different kind of game. So that's, they did not pursue the same off-court interest. But on the court, it worked beautifully. And Michael himself says that Dennis is one of the smartest guys that he ever played with. I think he had enormous respect for the fact that Dennis, no matter what he did with his extracurricular time, was always going to show up and be reliable. You'll see later on in the series that Dennis Rodman goes to wrestle, misses practice after game 3 of the NBA Finals to go wrestle with Hulk Hogan in a WCW during the finals. And this was something that was okay with the Bulls because they just knew that's Dennis being Dennis, but he's going to show up. And he comes back in game 4 against the Jazz and gets 14 rebounds. So they knew what they were getting with him, and I think they have 3 additional titles because of it.
Incredible. Let me finally ask you this. One of the stars of the series is not even on camera. That's the soundtrack itself. There's the 63-point performance in Boston set to LL Cool J's I'm Bad. There was the Party Man sequence this past weekend and the late big pun for Rodman's Vegas trip. Have you and everybody involved approached the use of music? How have you done so, and how much does it fire it up to, or fire you up to see the way the audience is responding to the use of music?
It's the most gratifying part of the process, to be honest, because to me it's the most important part of the process. The first thing I do at the outset of any project is this walk around my neighborhood in New York and listen to music that may or may not be used in the project, but just something that's going to get me in that right creative zone to start thinking about how this thing's going to look and feel and oftentimes sound. So I've been listening to the songs that we've used for, you know, years now, and it's a credit to our music clearance people, Rudy Chung, and Hit the Ground Running is a company that we used in Los Angeles to clear those songs. But Rudy and I work really well together. I personally choose every single one of those songs, and I put immense amount of thought into it. And to clear those songs is really difficult. Old school hip hop is the hardest thing to clear in music because of all the samples and tracking down so many people. So I'm really proud that people are responding the way that they have, and I think it adds just another layer. And there's way more coming. People like what they've heard before. And they're going to really enjoy what's to come.
He is a director. The projects include Andre the Giant, 30 for 30 on the Fab Five and the 85 Bears. The latest project, of course, is the one we've been talking about, The Last Dance. Episodes 5 and 6 air Sunday night, 9 p.m. and 10 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Jason Ayer, my guest. Jason, really nice to have you on. Thank you so much. Great work by you, and I really appreciate that conversation.
Thanks for having me, man. I enjoyed it.
Like, everybody already knew that Alex Smith was one of the classiest guys ever in the NFL. Ever, not hyperbole, like ever. If you didn't know, all you had to do was watch the way he handled things in Kansas City when Patrick Mahomes was drafted. Smith knew he was going to eventually lose his job to Mahomes, but he didn't get pissed off about that. He didn't refuse to help out the youngster. In fact, he did the exact opposite. He taught Mahomes everything that he had learned in his whole career. Smith! Andy Reid said before the Super Bowl, Smith taught Mahomes, quote, how to study, diet, his workout regimen, and how to get family acclimated into the NFL, end quote. Mahomes himself said, quote, it was the stuff that takes your whole career to learn, and he taught me that in my first year, and it's helped me have success at such an early age, end quote. Again, that tells you what kind of a guy Alex Smith is. In true to form, Smith texted Mahomes right after the Super Bowl to say that he enjoyed the win as much as the rest of the team did. Smith didn't have to do any of that. I mean, he didn't have to do all of that, but he didn't have to do any of that. And you know, a lot of guys wouldn't have, but Alex Smith did. So you already knew what a class act he was. We already knew that. Now you have proof that Alex Smith is tough as hell. Alex Smith is the toughest guy in football. And yes, I said it. And not only did I say that, but that might actually be an understatement. He might be the toughest guy on the planet. After he was dealt to Washington, he led that team to a 6-3 start to the 2018 season. Then in a game against Houston, he was sacked and he suffered a major injury to his right leg. And again, major is a major understatement. Catastrophic is more accurate. He suffered a compound fracture of the tibia and a fractured fibula as well. If you're not familiar with it, a compound fracture is when the bone penetrates the skin. It comes right out of the skin. It comes through the skin. It's the stuff of nightmares. And the injury was only the start because Smith had more things to go through because the wound became infected, and then he had to battle sepsis, which can be life-threatening and definitely leg-threatening. He spent an extended period of time under heavy sedation. His memory of what followed is not clear, but as he told Jeremy Schapp earlier this year.
Next thing I remember is waking up several weeks later faced with the decision of amputation or limb salvage at that point.
Two of the scarier things that you could ever imagine, right? Amputation and limb salvage. Amputation. Ampu-freaking-tation. This guy comes out of the sedation, heavy sedation, wakes up, and they're like, hey, Alex, you here? All right, we got to talk about something for a minute. Your leg? We may have to cut it off. Wait, what? What's been going on? How long was I asleep? I mean, and then you see the photo, not to make light of this, but you see the photo of that leg that was released ahead of a documentary about the comeback, and you understand why. If you haven't seen this, and you're thinking about eating today or the rest of the week, I wouldn't look at it. In fact, I'm not even going to show it on TV. It's revolting. It's disgusting. If you see it, you will not be able to get it out of your head for days. As I mentioned, I caught it out of the corner of my eye on one of our monitors in the studio during the show yesterday, and I threw up in my mouth. I'm like, holy crap, what is that? And I'm looking up, and I'm like, oh, that's Alex Smith's leg. It looked like somebody ran over his leg with a train and then set it on fire and then ran over it again. It does not look like the kind of injury you suffer on a football field. It looks like something from a horrific car accident or a firefight or something even worse. I mean, it does not look human. If you had told me it was a picture of something that was on board one of Tom's UFOs, I would have believed that. That does not look like the leg on a person, let alone on an NFL quarterback. And it sure as hell does not look like a leg that can be used to run on, much less walk on, or play football on, even in the backyard, and not the NFL. He's undergone 17 surgeries since the injury. 17. Like, you go through that, you're tough as hell. You go through that, and you still think about playing in the NFL, you are legendarily tough. I mean, it's unbelievable. You see that photo, and then you hear him talking about the journey and the work he's put in. It's jaw-dropping. As Smith said in the trailer for the documentary, from what I understand, this has never happened to a professional athlete. But think about that for a minute. This has never happened to a professional athlete. Yeah, I can't imagine it has, because I've never seen anything like that before in my life. You see that photo of his leg, and you hear about the possibility of amputation or death. And then you see this guy pushing a sled in rehab, in training. And there's nothing but respect. Honestly, I have awe. Never mind respect, awe. He's gone from playing football at the highest level to possibly having his leg removed. And that'd be the best thing. And now he's saying that football might not be out of the question. This guy literally could have died, could have lost his leg in the very least, and he's saying that playing football again in the NFL is not out of the question. It's mind-blowing. It's amazing to me. I mean, like, I can't get that image out of my head of his leg, and it's not even my leg. It's his leg, and I'm haunted by the image. I can't unsee it. Like, and I'm not the guy living with it. I can't even imagine the nightmare that he and his family have lived through and that he has chosen to battle through. Just walking right now would be an enormous win. But if he somehow comes back to throw a pass in the NFL, that's the stuff of legends. Classy as hell, tough as hell, inspirational as hell. Like, on the one hand, I can't wait to see this documentary. On the other hand, I'm not sure I can stomach watching it. And this guy's living it and doing the work. The last several years, I've believed that David Goggins was the toughest man on earth. Now I think it might be Alex Smith, having seen what I've seen and heard what I heard. Alex Smith, I mean, we knew he was the classiest guy you'll ever find. Come to find out, he's the toughest guy ever. Isaiah Simmons is my guest. Isaiah, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you doing?
Good, good. Great to have you. So can you take me back to Thursday night? You were in Kansas with your family. I'm kind of curious. You spent your whole life working towards this. What kind of emotions were you feeling during the day and the hours leading up to the draft?
Honestly, it's kind of weird, but when I woke up, it kind of just felt like it was a regular day. But the more and more we got closer to the time of the draft starting, the more and more I started to feel different emotions. For the most part, it was really surreal, just because it was my dream finally coming true. And when the Bengals first got on the clock, I started feeling butterflies in my stomach. I was like, okay, now this is actually real. This is actually happening. But overall, it was a lot of joy. I felt like it was a relief, finally figured out where I was going to be spending many years of my life. So it was really a great time, a great experience.
That's a great explanation right there. Isaiah Simmons joining us. So what about the call itself? You get the call from the Arizona Cardinals. What do you remember about that call in that moment?
Actually, the first call I got actually failed. So I got a little nervous at first, but we ended up getting the next call to go through. But, you know, I was, like I said, it was a relief. Finally figured out where I was going. And I found out I was going to a great program, a great, you know, culture, and a team that, you know, I knew was going to get it done. Just based upon, I saw the people that the Cardinals had acquired in free agency and as well as adding me. And I knew that it was going to be something special. So I was really excited.
Yeah, they're building something big there. Isaiah Simmons is my guest. You know, your journey really is something. Like, if we were to go back to high school, you were a three-star recruit, and some schools were ignoring you because, as the story goes, they couldn't figure out exactly where you would play. So you tell me, what were you like as a player in high school, and then what was it like not to get that recruiting love from schools at that time?
Not getting that love, I always felt like it was something that I deserved. And in high school, I was kind of more of an offensive player. At least that's what I thought. But I always felt as if I deserved to have more of the powerhouse schools. But finishing everything out, Clemson finally came along, and I'm glad that they did. Because it just gave me the opportunity to elevate my career. So I've been really blessed for Coach Sweeney and Coach Venable taking that opportunity on me. But I always felt as if I deserved more attention than I did. But I know a lot of that attention comes from going to camps and stuff, and that just wasn't something that I was getting into. But at the end of the day, everything has seemed to work out in my favor.
No doubt. Isaiah, for those who don't know the story goes that Clemson had three DBs enter the draft in 2016. So Brent Venables, who you mentioned, was suddenly looking for another player. And because he's from Kansas, he had heard about you. He says that when he saw you, he wanted an autograph. So what do you remember about Clemson reaching out at that time? And what made you feel like that was the place you wanted to be?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't really know much about Clemson. And I remember walking into school one day and my high school coach was like, "Have you talked to Venables?" And I was like, "Who is that?" I didn't even know who Coach Venables was.
Right.
The only thing I knew about Clemson was Sammy Watkins went there and they had just played the national championship. So, you know, it was strange, but I started learning more things about them, figured out what state they were in. And when Coach Venables finally came, he convinced me to take a visit to Clemson and actually canceled one of my officials, which was going to Louisville. So I canceled that and ended up going to Clemson. And, you know, it was obviously, you know, the best thing I could have done.
You know, I've done this a long, long time. I've interviewed thousands of athletes, coaches, personalities over the years. I'm not sure I've ever talked to anybody quite like Dabo Sweeney. What was it like to play for him and spend time around him?
It was everything and more that you saw from the media. As great as he is as a coach, he's an even better mentor. He gives us so much word of advice that will stick with us forever. And he takes care of us football-wise, but he also makes sure that we're going to be set for life. So equipped with all the tools that we'll need in the real life, because he really stresses us that football is not forever. So he's a great mentor and even, you know, a great coach as well.
Talking to Arizona Cardinal Isaiah Simmons, I want to talk about mindset for a minute, because everybody knows about your speed, but Venables has said, quote, "What you can't put on a stopwatch, I've said it once, I've said it 100 times, he plays so hard, his endurance is like nothing I have ever been around, that's his best attribute, he works so hard," end quote. So my question, where does the desire and that grind and that work ethic come from?
So growing up, I was a track guy, so I thought, and my coaches growing up, they were all Jamaican, and they used to make me cry when I was a kid, and if I didn't run the time that I was supposed to run in practice, I had to run again until I got the time, and, you know, they really just taught me how to work and how to and know the limits with my body, and ever since then, I just haven't known anything different. So working hard, if I'm not working hard, is weird to me. So I really only have one speed, and that's full go.
All right, so you've only got one speed, but it's not like you have only one position. As a lot of people know, you can play just about anywhere on the field and everywhere. It'd be so much easier to focus on that one position. So what is it about the challenge of playing everywhere that you like so much?
I just like how it just teaches you about all the different positions. So when playing everywhere, you quickly learn all the dynamics of the defense and the holes of the defense and what you can and can't do and where your teammates are going to be at what time. And it just, it really helps you, or in case me, help play a lot faster as a player.
Before you go, let me ask you a couple of really quick things. You made the point that your mom went to Creighton and has a master's from Bowling Green. So schoolwork clearly was something pretty important to you. What did you learn from her about that approach? And then how much does that help you with the mental side of football and preparation?
Just growing up, that she really just prepared me that to know that the mental aspect of everything, not just football, it's so important. And it can take you so far, just mentally preparing for all the right things. And just starting off with school, school was always first. Sports were always second. Having fun with friends was always second. So just being able to handle my business mentally with school and taking on the loads that I did really prepared me to elevate my game mentally.
Isaiah Simmons, my guest. Listen, when you do what you do, it's pretty hard for people to come up with other players to compare you to. But Steve Keim of the Cards said that you remind him of Brian Urlacher. Others have said that you're kind of like a much bigger version of Tyrann Mathieu. What do you make of those comparisons, and who are the guys that you study in the NFL?
Yeah, so I've heard the Brian Urlacher comparison quite a bit, and as well as the Tyrann Mathieu. But, you know, somebody who I would compare myself to and a guy that I've studied a lot is Derwin James, just because he also has, like, a similar skill set as I do, and he also plays multiple roles in his defense that he's in now as well as Florida State. So I actually, you know, me and Derwin, we actually are good friends and had the opportunity to work out with him. And, you know, I feel like he's just a good comparison just based off what he does.
So finally, the other day you said, quote, "I'm like, dang, I'm finally in the pros. I've been dreaming for this. Every day I wake up and I'm like, I'm a Cardinal. Let's get it." End quote. I really like the attitude. What do you want the Cards fans to know about you and how you're going to approach being a pro and what they're getting in you as a player and a person?
Yeah, so my work ethic is never going to stop, even though I made it to what I've dreamt of. I'm always hungry for more things, and I never get satisfied. And, you know, I just want the fans to know that I'm going to be a guy that's going to come in and be an immediate impact.
Good night now!